Well, it's interesting that you've collected these similarities, because I think that's really important when you're dealing with nutritionists, to look at the similarities, because the differences can be so strange that, you know, you could be completely lost. And I look at my own heritage, and I'm Italian and Irish. So, you know, how can I figure out what to eat? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
How does that make sense unless you take the similarities? So,
right.
So I'd like to talk about some of those similarities now and break some of those down and see what we come out on the other end with.
Okay. Well, what we do, what everybody does, the four things, I'll just go over the four pillars. I'll start with probably the most familiar, which is fresh. So every culture everywhere eats fresh food. That's just, that's where we talk about the seasonal stuff. And, you know, but not just plants. I also advise that it's important to eat fresh animal food. And by fresh, I mean uncooked. So cultures everywhere, indigenous cultures, and even today, a lot of modernized cultures outside of America still enjoy lots of fresh vegetables, fresh nuts, and fresh eggs that have just been whipped or prepared in a way where that they're not cooked or heated at all. The fresh animal meats, organ meats of the animals, all kinds of uncooked fresh stuff. And what that does, what fresh food has in it that cooked food doesn't, are a whole range of nutrients that are sensitive to heat and destroyed by heat, and most notably antioxidants. So when you cook, if you have, like, say, a pea, if you have it raw, you're going to be getting a lot more antioxidants than if you cook it. It's still good, got a lot of nutrients in it, as long as you don't cook it to death, or, you know, we're not talking about canned peas. But so you get different types of nutrition between whether it's raw or cooked. And so that's the first pillar, the most familiar, fresh. And by the way, a lot of herbs and spices, especially herbs, we do consume those raw. And there's so many, what strikes me as, the right word is capitalizing on people's ignorance, where there's all kinds of supplement companies selling basically herbs in capsules instead of just, you know, directing people to, okay, if you're going to have a salad, use fresh herbs. Or if you're going to have any dish, finish it with some fresh herbs, and you'll get the same benefits. In fact, more, because it hasn't sat around in a capsule or been dehydrated first. So fresh food, very important. So the second pillar that we talk about is fermented and sprouted. And this one may be familiar to a lot of your listeners, but is not familiar to a lot of my patients, in the beginning at least. Now, fermented foods, we do have a lot of experience with, though, even though we may not know it. Like yogurt, that's one of the most common fermented foods that still is living and still contains live bacteria in there. And the claims that the Activia manufacturers make that it works, you know, it helps your immune system and your digestion, I believe are completely true. And so I do encourage people to, if they like yogurt, eat that. But there's other fermented foods that you can eat as well. You can make your own sauerkraut just by with cabbage and salt and letting it sit at the right temperature and the right conditions for a couple weeks, and you get some sauerkraut with lots of good probiotics. You can buy it that way. So I encourage people to start adding those into their diets. And then, so that's fermented, and then sprouted is another way. I include these two together in the second pillar because both of them are essentially letting nature take its course, working with nature to enhance the nutritional value of a raw food product. So sprouting, is something that people have heard of, starting in the 70s when a lot of the hippie types were sprouting lentils and eating sprouts on salad. That's very good. Also, when you sprout wheat, you can make a dough out of that and then make bread out of that, and that is the way that bread was originally made in Bible times. So A lot of the brand names that do that have biblical names, and one of the most popular is Ezekiel, and I recommend that to my patients frequently. And the other thing about sprouted grain breads is that because when you germinate the seed, you wake the enzymes up that are capable of converting stored starch, which is basically sugar, which is basically empty calories, to something much more diverse, tasty, and better for you. That is amino acids, vitamins, and fiber. And the enzymes within the seed can do that. And so if you work with them by germinating them, you reduce the starch content by 10 to 30%, maybe more depending how long you let it go for, and you increase the nutrient content by that much as well. So that's the second pillar, fermented and sprouted. The third pillar is something I call meat on the bone. And now this is a pillar that is almost completely absent from the American diet because very few of us anymore go through the trouble of making bone stock by boiling bones. And what you do when you do that, you know, like a lot of people do that after Thanksgiving, where they have a whole turkey carcass and they just throw it in the pot and boil it with some vegetables and they make a turkey soup out of it. If you've ever done that, you've probably noticed that when you cool it down, there's a gelatinousness to the stock. And that is there because there's gelatin in there. And gelatin has a very special molecule called glycosaminoglycan. It's actually a family of molecules. And these glycosaminoglycans have the unique ability, no other molecule is known to do this, to stimulate cells called fibroblasts, which produce collagen, which produce the stuff your joints need. Your joints are all lined with collagen, your tendons are made out of collagen, your ligaments are as well, your arteries are, your heart valves, your kidneys are full of collagen. And when you eat glycosaminoglycans, they do not get digested. They get a free pass out of your digestive system into your bloodstream. They circulate around to any tissues that have recently been exercised or injured. And they did some really interesting studies in poor little mice where they injured their joints, and they radiolabeled the glycosaminoglycan, and they saw this movement, and they saw where it ended up, the radiation ended up in their joints. So essentially it's like a growth hormone for connective tissue, and if you're not getting it, it is a little harder for your connective tissues to regenerate, especially if you eat meat. Now, vegetarians don't eat quite so much, and the reasoning for that is a little bit complicated, but it has to do with the fact that cooked meat is difficult for your kidneys to process, and there's compounds in there that can actually bind to your connective tissues and cause some damage. So if you eat meat, you absolutely need to have these glycosaminoglycans in your diet. You absolutely need to save those bones. Any bones will do. It's the shiny stuff on the ends of the bones that has this magic chemical in them called glycosaminoglycans. And that's good for the planet, too, because if we are eating animals, the worst thing we can do is waste the tissues and not use the parts that we could be using and just, you know, use them for... I mean, they do get used, right? But they get used for things like glue and ash for cat food. And when you have farmers going through the trouble of raising grass-fed meats, and then they can't sell the bones to people, and they have to, you know, sell them, or get rid of them, or throw them away in some cases, it's a real shame. So it just helps to promote healthy farming, and I believe it is good for the planet and the balance of the planet. So that's the third pillar. And the fourth is, we call it organ meats. And the reason it deserves its own special pillar has to do with the fact that it's so foreign to the American diet. And organ meats like liver and kidney and brains are powerhouses of nutrients that a lot of people are walking around needing to take in the form of supplements like omega-3 fats or biotin or phospholipids and choline. Organ meats are rich in a lot of these things, a lot of these essential nutrients. And if we, again, if we, just like with the bones, if we are not eating them ourselves, people who are going through the trouble of raising healthy animals are having to get rid of, throw out sometimes these potentially, you know, life-giving parts of the animal, and it's a shame. So I see it as something that is good also for the planet, and it connects us with our farmers and connects us with our culinary roots, because there are so many traditional recipes in some of the cookbooks that were published before 1930. Like I have one that I'm dying to try next apple season called bone marrow apple pie. So instead of butter, right? Instead of butter and sugar, actually, it's bone marrow, because there's a lot of sweetness in those fats. So a lot of cool stuff out there that our ancestors used to do, and getting in touch with our culinary roots, basically. So if you were Italian and Irish, I actually am French, Russian, Irish, and one more thing, English. Your ancestors still all did the same, those same four things in common. So all you have to do is find a recipe that for fresh, something fresh. That's, you know, local food, because that's what they did, right? Wherever they were, their local was similar, because people always raised vegetables, they raised nuts, they ate oils, they raised animals. So there's so many commonalities, and they of course ate fish and seafood. So there really are a lot more commonalities than we often recognize, because the spices are different.
Sure. I think it's a trend in say a strict vegetarian community to use some of the traditional research and forget that maybe five, or depending on what culture, but anywhere from, you know, 1 to maybe even 20, 30, 40% of these cultures' diets were from animal foods. I mean, I'm sure you've done, I know you've done plenty of research. You talk about the Maasai, you talk about the Himba, you talk about a few different other cultures in your book. I mean, do you see that happening? That it's kind of like they're looking the other way?
Yeah. This happens when people their thinking has been colored by our American culture, which is that meat is bad. It's been vilified ever since 1950, when this gentleman named Ansel Keys said something about solid fat seems to be clogging our arteries. P.S., the research he later did showed that solid fat was not butter. It was margarine that was starting to be used. But that mistake never got corrected. We associate solid fat with animal fat because it looks solid, even though many of the fatty acids in, for instance, chicken fat are polyunsaturated. And I think if you compare chicken fat to almonds or avocados, it's got more polyunsaturates and less basically solid fat. It's just, you know, it looks rigid because it's within that rigid structure of connective tissue. So anyway, yes, people are highly, highly colored by that bias. And so there's a really great book by, I forget his name, but the book is called The Blue Zones. And the author traveled to four different countries, including Italy and Costa Rica, Japan, and looked at what the healthy older folks were doing. And he's describing the four pillars. He literally goes to this one Italian gentleman who's making sausage, who is up to his elbows in blood, making sausage. It's really grim, the picture he paints when he comes to visit this 70-year-old, extremely healthy guy. But yet at the end of the chapter, the conclusion is, if you want to be healthy, for what the Italians do that makes them so healthy is eat fresh vegetables and laugh a lot and drink wine. You know, no mention of the sausage or, you know, the connection to the land, the use of the whole animal. So it's just that either because there is an agenda really preventing people from saying these things in books that are published by the mainstream, or they truly are just colored by the constant message that animal foods are killing us. And they really can't see what's right in front of their eyes.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that you're absolutely correct. There is almost no... There's no culture that I know of that generation after generation was strictly vegan. And there are some newish cultures in India where people go in and out of being vegetarian, a generation after generation, but not a consistent. It's not a consistent thing.
In many of those cultures in India, they include dairy. They use ghee or cow's dairy as well. So it's important to know that for those who are listening. I've introduced some dairy into my own diet, some fermented dairy. And what I want to ask you is, you know, even if a culture is eating 1% or 2% of the calories of animal product, I mean, is that significant enough to actually show or to improve their health?
Well, I think the way I would answer that would be by making sure that they really are getting those four pillars. You know, you can do three of the four without eating anything other than fish in terms of the animal world, the animal kingdom. You can actually do all four if you make bone stock from fish. But if you don't want to eat any animals at all, but you still do eat eggs, because egg yolk has a lot of similarities to organ meat in terms of the nutrient profiles, you could technically be getting pretty close to three of the four pillars and getting all those wonderful things that your genes do need. But the one thing you won't get unless you cook bones is the meat on the bone, the glycosaminoglycans. And there's some research that suggests that when you cook animal protein, you get more, like the protein is more available. There's not a heck of a lot of research on that, so I can't be extremely confident that it really makes that much of a difference, but there is some research to support it. Like, you know, people who need to gain weight do gain weight faster when they include cooked meat as opposed to just eating it raw. And there are some studies, conversely, that show that people who do all raw, women especially, lose their menstrual periods, they lose weight. And so if you wanted to reproduce, that would not be optimal conditions.
I want to have a few questions about your information on carbohydrates in the book. First, why don't you explain a little bit about your stance on carbohydrates, and then I want to question a little bit about, you know, some of the longer-lived cultures who do have maybe 50, 60%, maybe even 70 or 80% carbohydrates in their diet. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Very important question. So what I see, of course, I live in America. I practice in America, and so a lot of my patients are eating a lot of cooked food and not a lot of fresh food. And so what one of the easiest ways to make them healthier is to cut their carbohydrates. And I cut it down to under 100, and I start to see all kinds of wonderful things happen, including weight loss without calorie restriction, which people love that because you don't have to be hungry and you can start seeing that belly go away. And the other very important thing that happens is that your blood sugar level tends to stay, it comes down. If you have diabetes, you can actually get off medications. Obviously, this is not something I recommend doing without close monitoring of your blood sugars and talking with your doctor. But all kinds of amazing things can happen. Even your cholesterol levels can improve because the high blood sugar actually interferes with the normal circulation of the fatty acid particles that carry cholesterol and lipids called lipoproteins. So your HDL goes up, your triglycerides go down. Lots of good things happen in the setting of an American diet when we cut our carbs down that low. The reason I'm so down on carbs has to do with the fact that when a human blood sugar level, and this seems to be true in animals as well, at least cats and dogs where the research has been done, when the blood sugar level is above about 90 or 100, which is actually below now where they are diagnosing diabetes, your body is forced to get it down because of the danger of high glucose in the blood, which comes from the fact that sugar is sticky. And so when your blood sugar levels are above about 90, there's these reactions that are going to be occurring at a rapid rate that involve a bonding of sugar, the blood sugar circulating in your bloodstream, to proteins all over your body, especially the connective tissues, because that's what holds our cells together. And so that we see a stiffening of the arteries called hypertension. We see stiffening of the heart called heart failure. We see a stiffening of the joints called arthritis. And it all comes from the fact that blood sugar levels above 90 are dangerous. When we're young, we have enough reserve in our pancreas to produce the insulin that will keep that blood sugar under control. Even though we may be buzzing on sugar all the time, it will go up a little bit. It will still go above 90 in a way that's not optimal, but we'll be able to get it down. But after a couple decades of doing that and of basically abusing your metabolism, you'll develop diabetes. And again, this is in the setting of an American diet, which is where most of the research that I'm familiar with has been done. So that's why I say that a healthy diet, and I say this in Deep Nutrition in Chapter 9, where I talk about the chemistry of how sugar affects our body, is that you got to keep it under 100. And that it's so interesting that I came up with that number, and then a couple other people completely independently of me come up with the same number, 100 grams a day, for weight loss and health. So I really think we're onto something. And this is all in the setting of a standard American diet. I know that there are people, and I saw some interesting interviews on your website with that doctor who spent some time in Peru. What was his name?
Yeah, Dr. Williams, sure.
Who visited with a tribe in Peru, and they had an astounding amount of potatoes in their diet, and I thought that was fascinating. But I was not too surprised to see that they were all very short. And what may be happening is that because they don't have processed foods in their diet, because they are still following presumably four pillar ways of communing with the earth and eating the earth, that they have not developed the diseases of Western civilization that shorten their lifespan, but they are not getting the amount of protein that, or perhaps even minerals that enables their bones to grow tall the way that that we grow in America. So a lot of them look to be somewhere around 4.5 feet. I wasn't down there, but I was just gauging based on comparing.
They're about 5'2" to 5'6" ish.
Right, so so they are shorter than us, and one really interesting extension of this is the discovery of the people somewhere in some islands in the South Pacific that they called the Hobbit. This was 18,000 years ago. There was a skeleton that was human in every way, except it looked to be somewhere around, I think, 3 feet tall. And they found what may be descendants of these people on the island still living, and their tallest person was somewhere around 4 feet tall. And it makes sense to me that on an island where resources are limited, where animal, especially, the places where animals would forage would be limited by human population and the humans growing the nutrient, the calorie-rich carbohydrates, that would sustain them and keep them alive, but not allow them to grow tall. So I think, to me, that's how I make sense of that.
Mm-hmm. And then the Okinawans as well would fit into that category, since they're not notoriously tall.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. And I have a little
60% of their diet is carbohydrate.
Yes. Right. Uh huh. Absolutely. Yeah, true. So, and I have a little diagram in, I think it's chapter 4, where I chart out how when the emperor at one point forbade the eating of meat, the average skeletal height went down a little bit, and then now in the 1800s when Japan opened its kind of cultural ways up a little bit to the Western society, they started eating meat again, they started growing taller, and then, of course, that took off with the more consumption of milk after 1940. So it kind of, you know, makes sense that when we can consume the minerals and more dense sources of protein, that we can grow bigger. Our bones actually are 90% protein, so we need them.
Sure.
We need protein for that.
And I'm looking at this diagram right now. It's just over 144 centimeters, and then it drops down below in 1857. So it starts in 300 AD, and then up around 1970, it almost comes up to about 160 centimeters. So it's about a, you know, what's that, 16 centimeter increase.
Yeah,
so it's kind of
pretty big. Big difference.
Yeah. No, well, I guess the question is, you know, is taller better or not, you know, right?
Right. Is it better? And, you know, I think in American society, unfortunately, you make more money if you're a man. I think it's something like $30,000 per year for every inch in height.
Very true.
Did you know that?
Yeah, there's studies that show that taller people, not too tall, but taller people do command more money in their employment, which is amazing.
Right. Well, I mean, we still are primal, you know. We still, the man still commands more attention from the other man if he's got this height advantage over him, you know. So Luke really watches that really closely, the way people shake hands and all that body language. And usually the taller person is kind of in charge of the scene, you know. You can watch the George Bush and Bill Clinton and now Obama and their interactions with other world leaders. And, you know, a lot of it boils down to height. The taller guy's leading the shorter guy, you know. It's kind of funny.
Well, great. Well, we're about running out of time here. Is there anything else that you wanted to add that you think would be valuable to share with our listeners?
I think the bottom line is that what I want to leave people with is that right now, you know, and probably your listeners are more sophisticated than this, but the conversation about food is calories and carbohydrates and stuff like that, we need to look beyond calories. Food really is literally chemical information, and it informs our DNA, and we can lose weight, if that's our health goal, by informing our DNA better and smarter, rather than starving ourselves, because diets fail if they don't kill fat cells, and to be able to eliminate fat cells takes a lot of biological technology. There's a cool link that I can give you later if you want to share it with your listeners about the process called cellular apoptosis, where cells basically shut themselves down. And this happens in fat cells. We can lose fat cells. And if we don't lose fat cells, our diets are going to fail. And it's not about calories. It's about information. So I talk about that on my website.
Well, great. Well, the website, there are two websites for Dr. Kate here. drcate.com, so that's just drkate.com. And if you're interested specifically in weight loss, trimprogram.com, trimprogram.com. The book is called Deep Nutrition. I think it's a valuable book to read regardless of your diet belief system or anything like that. You can always gain new information and great little bits of things that you can use for your own diet regardless of you know, what the author's viewpoint is. So I recommend you checking it out at drkate.com. Dr. Kate, thanks for being on the call today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been fun.
This has been Kevin Gianni and Dr. Kate Shanahan. We want to thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time. Take care.